Okay, here's on page 571, text 6 and 7. Mahabhutanyahankaro bhutir avyaktam evacha indriyanam daishaikam cha pancha chandriya gocharaha icha dvesha sukham dukham sangata shetana dhritihi etad shetram samasena savikaram udharitam. Mahabhutani, the great elements. Ahankara, false ego. Buddhi, intelligence. Avyaktam, the unmanifested. Eva, certainly. Cha, also. Indriyani, the senses. Dasha, ekam, 11. Cha, also. Pancha, 5. Cha, also. Indriya, gocharaha, the objects of the senses. Icha, desire. Dvesha, hatred. Sukham, happiness. Dukham, distress. Sangataha, the aggregate. Chetana, living symptoms. Dhritihi, conviction. Etat, all this. Kshetram, the field of activities. Samasena, in summary. Savikaram, with interactions. Udharitam, exemplified. The five great elements: false ego, intelligence, the unmanifested, the 10 senses and the mind, the 5 sense objects, desire, hatred, happiness, distress, the aggregate, the life symptoms and convictions. All these are considered in summary to be the field of activities and its interactions. Purport. From all the authoritative statements of the great sages, the Vedic hymns and the aphorisms of the Vedanta Sutra, the components of this world can be understood as follows. First, there are earth, water, fire, air, and ether. These are the 5 great elements, Mahabhuta. Then there are false ego, intelligence, and the unmanifested stage of the 3 modes of material nature. Then there are the 5 senses for acquiring knowledge, the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and skin. Then 5 working senses, voice, legs, hands, anus, and genitals. Then above the senses, there is the mind, which is within, and which can be called the sense within. Therefore, including the mind, there are 11 senses altogether. Then there are the 5 objects of the senses, smell, taste, form, sound, and touch and sound. Now the aggregate of these 24 elements is called the field of activity. If one makes an analytical study of these 24 subjects, then he can very well understand the field of activity. Then there are desire, hatred, happiness, and distress, which are interactions, representations of the 5 great elements in the gross body. The living symptoms represented by consciousness and conviction are the manifestation of the subtle body, mind, ego, and intelligence. These subtle elements are included within the field of activities. The 5 great elements are a gross representation of the false ego, which in turn represents the primal stage of false ego, technically called the materialistic conception, or tamasabhuti, intelligence in ignorance, jadabhuti parihari, prasada bhojanakari. Jadabhuti, same thing. This further represents the unmanifested stage of the 3 modes of material nature. The unmanifested modes of material nature are called pradhan. One who desires to know the 24 elements in detail, along with their interactions, should study the philosophy in more detail. In Bhagavad Gita, a summary only is given. The body is the representation of all these factors, and there are changes of the body which are 6 in number. The body is born, it grows, it stays, it produces byproducts, then it begins to decay, and at the last stage it vanishes. Therefore, the field is a non-permanent material thing. However, the kshetrajna, the knowledge that the knower of the field, its proprietor, is different. The concept is simple. That there's a gross and subtle body, and then beyond that there's the spiritual soul who inhabits the body. And this chapter describes how there's a super knower within the body, and how we're interacting with that field of activities, which include, in summary, these 24 elements. They're divided differently by different philosophers, but in general, there's 24. And the Sankhya philosophy, which you can, it probably says, here there's just a summary study given, but if you want more detail, you can go into the Srimad Bhagavatam. And Lord Kapiladev gives detailed explanation of the various elements and how they come into existence, how they're each manifest. And ultimately, the conclusion is that I really have nothing to do with this material world. When the body is finished, it has no more use. It is thrown away. As the Farsis, they put it up for the vultures, isn't it? They put it on a big high platform. The vultures come and eat the body, and then the vultures pass stool. So then you could take that stool, and if you give a grant to somebody at Stanford University, they can maybe make a new person. Possible? I don't think so. Not possible. So the body is Om Kratos Smara Kritam Smara, Kratos Smara Kritam Smara. Let this temporary body be burnt to ashes and let the air of life be merged with the totality of air. Now, my Lord, please remember all my sacrifices, and because you are the ultimate beneficiary, please remember all that I've done for you. In the 17th verse of the Sri Upanishad, Vayura Anilam Amritam Atedam Bashman Tam Shariram. The devotees praying at the time of death, or remembering what the time of death, or projecting what the time of death will be like, that he's surrendering the elements of this body back into their original state. And he's thinking the only thing that's valuable in this life, nothing that I've accumulated I can keep. What's valuable is whatever contribution to service I've made in this lifetime, because that's permanent. Neha brikramana shosti prativayo navidyate swalpamapyasya dharmasya trayate mahato bayat. Even a little advancement in devotional service is cumulative. It's not lost. And it can protect one from this most dangerous type of fear, which is sliding back down from the opportunity in the human life into the lower species. So remembering that the body is an accumulation, is the field, and we're the knower of the field, and that especially that there's the super soul who's the controller of the field of activities, and who's also providing everything for us. We're dependent, and he is the master in all circumstances. This is knowledge. So Bhagavad Gita gives us preliminary understanding of this in a very simple and clear way. Hari Guru Prabhu.
Prabhuji, could you comment on how this analytical study of this material world, including the soul, leads to devotional service? Because Prabhupada mentions in second chapter that Sankhya and devotional service is related. I'm not sure how. It might be based on the things that you just mentioned, that once you realize that this is temporary and all. But could you shed more light on that?
Well, it's sort of like, you know, when your whole house, if you're living in your house and it's a mess and you don't know when your appointments are, you're not even sure what the date is, and you become very depressed and frustrated because you're not sure what to do next. So then you make a plan to clean your house. And step by step, somehow or other, you put everything in its place. And then you get your calendar upright and you set your watch to the right time. And you sort everything out, and then you can see clearly now how I'm going to move forward, what's my purpose. And Sankhya really means it's a process of putting everything in order so you can see what your priority is. And you're meant to sort through everything, put it in its proper perspective. Sambandha Gyan means then we come to the point of what... Where am I in all this? That's what you want to know. Where am I and what am I supposed to do? And when you do that, when you sort everything out and you start from the beginning and you say, okay, I'm not the body, and you can do this daily. In fact, this process is it's immediately effective in many kinds of circumstances. I had this experience on Sankirtan many times, especially years ago. I remember when sometimes we'd sell a book to somebody and then they'd walk away and they'd become... someone would tell them, oh, you don't need this book. You should go get your money back or something like that. That used to happen a lot in the airport. And they'd come back in an angry mood or something like that. And then the first thing, I found the most effective thing to tell them to start with saying is, so this book talks about how you're not your body. And we're something different from the body. And it's such a revolutionary idea compared to what everyone's absorbed in on a daily basis, just identifying with the mind and the senses and being carried away by all these things, that most of the time people would become disarmed and think, oh, well, this is different, and start from a different perspective. So coming to know what is the priority in the world, and then ultimately who is the soul of existence. Narupam asyeha tatopalabhyate nanto na chadirna tasampratishta ashvatameram suvarudamulam asanga shastrena dridhena chitva. So Krishna says the material world is like a banyan tree, and you can't see the form. You can't see the beginning and the end because it's so vast. And then he says you have to cut it down with the weapon of detachment. And then after that, you have to search out the original Supreme Person who's the source of that tree, who's the source of everything, and then surrender to him. So Sankhya does that. It helps you to sort through all the what is what. What is important, what is matter, what is spirit, and then search out the source of all of them.
So it is a process of clarifying the thought in a way, or developing a clear vision of where one is on the whole process and how to go ahead. So just because the fact that it's linked to Krishna, it's considered devotional service. The reason I'm saying this is because there are, if it was not for the fact that one is trying to advance in reviving their relationship with Krishna, the activities just in themselves would have been called as speculative process, like you're trying to analyze things without any objective. You wouldn't know what you're looking at. So the process looks very similar to the process of acquiring, I wouldn't say acquiring, but it's very similar to a process of involving jnanis, like jnan, those who are trying to seek out knowledge. But because we are trying to be connected to Krishna, this process is synonymous with devotional service. Is that the right way of looking at it?
Well, it's put it like this: to the degree that there is bhakti mixed into any process, it's valuable. This is Kaviraj Goswami says in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, that any process without bhakti is weak and feeble. It doesn't have any strength. To the degree that bhakti is mixed into the process, to that degree it actually has efficacy and strength. And therefore Prabhupada says in the Bhagavad Gita that there's karma, but when it's mixed with bhakti, it becomes karma yoga. And there's jnana. And when it's mixed with bhakti, it becomes jnana yoga. And the ultimate goal is to come to the highest rung of the ladder, which is bhakti yoga. So if you don't have that goal, if you don't have the goal of reestablishing a relationship with Krishna, then whatever situation or whatever kind of study you're doing, it's not valuable. It's not, there's no direction to it. In just regular study of the universe, in which it's taboo to actually mention that there is a supreme cause of all causes. You know, if you, in your physics, as a physics professor, if you go in and you start saying, actually, we're looking for God here, unless you have really strong ties with the university and good tenure, you'll be drummed out of the university. You'll be drummed out of the academy, because that's not allowed. It's not permissible to talk about God. And yet the search goes on. They say, atheistic researchers would say that there is no absolute truth. Yet they continue to search. We say there is an absolute truth. So who's crazy? The person who goes on searching for something they say ultimately isn't there, or those who say there is an absolute truth? So the goal has to be coming back to Krishna. Otherwise, in a related verse in the Bhagavatam, the demigods praying to Krishna within the womb said, Yene ravindaksha vamuktamaninas toyasta bhavada vashuddha buddhaya aruya krishtena paramparam tata patantyato nadrita yushmarangraya. That whatever kind of endeavor you're doing and whatever imagined type of liberation you think you've attained, if it doesn't include reconnecting with our source, Krishna, the lotus-eyed, he's got eyes, then this is aruya krishtena. It's very hard work, and from that, you'll fall back down from that position. There's no actual resting place. It's only imagined. So there's a yoga ladder, and there are various stages on that yoga ladder. The original cause for a living entity becoming implicated in the material world is ignoring Krishna. This is stated by Kavi Yogendra in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhayam dvitiya binibeshata syad ishara petasya viparyayo smritihi tanmayato tad buddha abhijet tam bhaktyaika yesham guru devata ma. He says that due to turning my head away from Krishna and becoming absorbed in the shadow or that which is not Krishna, I become full of fear, and this is the symptom of material existence. The remedy is to turn one's attention back to Krishna. So ignorance means ignorance. I've ignored Krishna, and therefore I'm implicated in materialistic life. In the process of material life, becoming implicated means associating with the three modes of material nature more and more. As stated in this chapter, Purusha Prakriti Stohi Bhunkte Prakriti Jangunan Kananam Guru Sango Sya Sarasad Yoni Janmasu. The cause of my good and bad situations and in various wombs and species of life is due to my association with three modes of material nature. There's a cycle of activity in this world where I become implicated more and more. To remedy that cycle, there's karma yoga. And that deals only with a certain realm of activity. And in the realm of subtle desire, through which I'm implicated in this material nature, there is Gyan Yoga. And it deals with that, particularly with that realm, the desires and the mental activities, the subtle nature of the body of the living entity. And then there's Dhyan Yoga, through which one can perceive the Supersoul to a certain degree. These are different rungs on the ladder of yoga, but the highest rung is bhakti. And the reason it's the highest rung is because the root cause of my implication in the material world is ignorance. It's ignoring Krishna, turning my head away. So bhakti, bhaktyaika yesham guru devatatma, means specifically to turn one's attention back towards Krishna, the root cause of everything, the original personality of Godhead, by pointing my attention towards him through the process of direct devotional service, which is Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Padasevanam. Yes, question?
I mean, you said...
Yeah, you need it because it's being broadcast internationally.
Oh, okay.
So my question was, you said that acquiring knowledge without Krishna is futile or something like that. I would think that if you start acquiring knowledge, at some point you would be realizing the truth that, you know, Krishna is the supreme person, I guess, or you know, the you know, he's spread all over, he's God. So why would that be futile, in the sense that whatever be the path you go to Krishna, you are, you know, that is also leading you to Krishna, because the more you know, like you said, in universities, you know, they want to know about the universe, all the laws, and maybe if you project, you know, what will happen like 1,000 years from now or 10,000 years from now, maybe they will realize, oh, okay, this is the, you know, we now, I mean, the body of science is not perfect yet, but maybe at some point they will realize that, yes, okay, we know what it all means. So why is that not a, and maybe if you do that and get to know Krishna that way, your bhakti is much more than if somebody without that knowledge knows Krishna. Or is there a difference between knowing Krishna?
You're putting a lot. Let's deal with one thing at a time, which is, if I understand you correctly, you're saying, how is knowledge futile? Because ultimately it might lead to something. You're saying ultimately knowledge will lead to something. So in this chapter, Krishna says what knowledge is. He gives his opinion about what real knowledge is. He says, Kshetra nang chapi mam vidhi sarva kshetrishu bharata kshetra kshetra gnyanam yattach gnyanam yatam mama. He says, my opinion is that knowledge means to know the difference between the knower of the field and the field, these two things. And my point was to pursue knowledge, or to pursue perfection, or some to accumulate knowledge, to analyze endlessly without a goal in mind, searching out the root of existence, the soul of existence, is futile. Because, and I mentioned that in certain circles, it's taboo to open oneself to the consideration of there being a consideration of God. So on one side, there's blind faith. And on the other side, there's blind doubt. You can have blind doubt. In the academy, there can be blind doubt, because that means that there's a ceiling on your investigation. You say, we have all these knowledge, but we will not entertain the idea of God, because that's counterproductive to the goal of the academy. If that's the case, if that's the mentality, then Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, mogasha moga karmano moga jnana vichetasa rakshasim asurim chaiva prakritim mohinim shritaha. If you have that kind of mentality, then mogasha means that your cultivation of knowledge will be baffled. And this is called maya prita jnana by Krishna. He mentions this specifically, that those who cultivate knowledge without the intention of understanding God, or actually to obscure and obfuscate others' search for God, that those people have the root of all knowledge stolen away from them, even though they accumulate a lot of facts and figures. They can do a lot of calculations and make a lot of things move around on paper, but ultimately they lose the very reason why they're looking for that. It's a state of heart. And is it beneficial to go through this process, you know, to accumulate knowledge and to, you know, hard struggle for knowledge? Well, Krishna mentions in the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Bahunam jamanamante gyanavam mam prapadyate vasudeva sarvamiti sa mahatma sudurlabaha. He says that after many, many births and deaths, one may become a jnani. And the jnani, the way Prabhupada gives, he gives a simplified example of three kinds of mentalities: karmi, jnani, and bhakta. So the karmi means that the world looks good to me, I'll try to enjoy it to the fullest extent. And he compares this to, there's a mirage in the desert. It looks like water, and I run for the water, and then I drop dead trying. This is material life, life of a karmi. Jnani means he's running and running, and after a while, through his calculations, he figures out that's fake water. And therefore, he stops running. He stops going for the water. So, but then the bhakta actually finds where the real water is. So, after searching and searching, jnanavam mam prapadyate, the real jnani surrenders to Krishna. So, if someone surrenders to Krishna without going through all that research and without, you know, all that hard work, he'll still come to the, he comes to the perfect stage, which is he attains Krishna, the shelter of Krishna, his lotus feet. And one who knows Krishna, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, yomam eva masam mudho, janati purushottamam, sasarva vid bhajatimam, sarva bhavina bharata. If somebody knows me, one who knows me, because he's the root cause of everything, he knows everything. He has all knowledge. Because the purpose of knowledge is to understand Krishna, and Krishna is the source of all knowledge. So you could take the long process, and Krishna mentions this. Arjuna even asks in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita about those who have, instead of taking the bhakti process, and seeing Krishna in his personal form and worshiping him, they worship the impersonal absolute. So Krishna says it's very troublesome. Klesho dikartarastesham, avyakta sakta chetasam, that unmanifested form of Krishna. Very difficult to fix one's mind on that. But after a long, long time of performing all kinds of charitable works and doing things, you know, to try to understand, one can come to the point of bhakti from doing that. So you can take the lift, or you can go up the stairs. But if your goal isn't to understand Krishna, then what's required actually is sukriti. Really where bhakti comes from is from the bhaktas. Bhakti isn't a result of any combination of items in this material world, and it's not a result of doing good work in this material world either. Bhakti comes from a special kind of good fortune, and that good fortune comes from Krishna's devotees because they distribute it. And when one comes in contact with devotees, he gets bhakti unmukhi sukriti. It's a kind of good fortune from doing service. It's called agyata sukriti. You do some unknown service and you get this kind of credit. And from that credit, your faith is awakened. And you become naturally inclined to take the devotional service. I mean, look at a lot of... you might have been around educational institutions during your life, right? And did you see a lot of progress from churning the numbers and seeing those who are studying various aspects of nature? Did you see a lot of progress in the process of devotional service from people doing that?
Well, I mean, maybe over accumulation of hundreds of years or thousands of years, there is
maybe,
progress.
Huh?
No, I mean to say that, I mean, there is definitely progress. I mean, people know more about more things.
But where?
They're not there yet, obviously. And maybe at some point they will be. They will have to be because all the knowledge
frustrated?
Has to come from Krishna. No. Because it has to come from Krishna. So they will at some point will know it. And my question was, do you think the bhakti that is generated by the people who have struggled and come to bhakti, is it stronger or better in quality than the bhakti of somebody who's just started with bhakti? I mean, shouldn't it be like, you know, more bhakti, like people who have struggled and looked around and, you know, they found the answer. Would that bhakti be stronger, better in quality than the person who has not done that and has come to bhakti?
Not necessarily. Krishna names, you know, we go by the Bhagavad Gita. This is the, you know, standard book on bhakti. And Krishna mentions how and why people come to devotional service and the different mentalities they have when they come to devotional service. So he says, Chaturvida bhajante imam jana sukritino arjuna arto jignasa artarti gyanicha bharatarshava. He says, four kinds of pious people come to devotional service. Who are they? They're the inquisitive. They're the person who's in knowledge. They're the distress and the desire of wealth. So sometimes people are struggling in the material world, so they approach God. Or sometimes they need money. They're very poor, so they come to God. And sometimes they're just inquisitive. And sometimes they're in full knowledge, so they come. And one thing that's important in this verse is what I just mentioned. This verifies more of the concept I was saying, that when someone has piety, Krishna says specifically in this verse, Chaturvida bhajante imam jana sukritina. These people are sukritina. It means they have some sukriti. That's why when they become distressed or their desires of wealth, inquisitive, they turn towards Krishna. Because before that, he mentions four kinds of people who don't come to Krishna. And those people are, help me out, what's the verse before that one? Namam duskritinu mudha, prapadyante naradama, maya aprita jnana asuram pavamashrita. I mentioned one already, maya aprita jnana. The person who has no intention of understanding God, and therefore he's researching for the purpose of obscuring God. He doesn't come to him. And there are other people, the mudha, Krishna's words. It says the person who thinks that the goal of life is to work hard just to try to get some sense gratification, like the donkey. Works hard all day pulling bricks, and there's a hope that he'll get, a carrot, which is dangled in front of him, or a little grass, which is available everywhere. Namam duskritinu mudha prapadyante naradama. Naradama means the lowest among men, those people who propound philosophies which take people away from God. Maya prita jnana. And those who are either jnanis, but their very sole purpose is to say there's no God. So these four kinds of people, Krishna says, they don't come to me. Then he names four kinds of people that come to him, and they're all sukritina, which means they have piety. They have some pious credit. They've gotten what's called daivi sampat. It's a kind of a spiritual capital that allows them, when they get in distress, when they're in desire of money, or when they're inquisitive, to turn towards God. And then they turn in that way. So what is Krishna's opinion about these four kinds of people? He says, Tesham jnani nitya yukta eka bhakti vishishite priyohi jnani no tyartam aham sacha mama priya. Out of the four, who's the most dear to him? The jnani, the intelligent one, the person who's actually intelligent. Then he says, Udaraksare evaite jnani tvatvaiva mebatam astitam sahiyukta mam evam utamam gatim. That the one who's in full knowledge and worshiping Krishna, out of bhakti, that's the highest person. He's the most magnanimous person, and he attains me. He comes to that position. Then he says, Bahunam jamanamante jnanavan mam prapadyate. But after many, many, many births and deaths in the material world struggling, one may become a jnani, and out of those jnanis, somebody may, a fortunate person may surrender to him, understanding, oh, Krishna is everything. He's the purpose behind all this. So is it sweeter if you struggled for many, many lifetimes, to come to Krishna? Devotional services, it's like, when you're thirsty and you get water, who cares where you got it from? When we come back to our original connection with Krishna, then it's sweet in all circumstances. Why delay the process? So my answer is, I don't necessarily agree that just because you took a roundabout way to come to Krishna, that your bhakti is better. Bhakti is bhakti. It's inherent in the soul. It's natural. If you think of it as it's the natural state of, it's our natural proclivity is to love Krishna, but now it's obscured. When we remove what's obscuring our bhakti and reconnect with Krishna, then we become fully satisfied. Just like a traveler who comes back home after so much trouble on the road.
But in the words that you said, so Krishna does say that somebody who comes to him in full knowledge, he is the most, loved or by Krishna. Is that?
Yeah, but ultimately it doesn't matter, because however you come to Krishna, the Bhagavatam's full of stories to encourage us how powerful bhakti is, that however you come to Krishna, you'll attain the highest benefit. Dhruva Maharaj is an example of someone who came because he needed money. He wanted to buy a kingdom bigger than his great-grandfather's. He wanted something bigger than Brahma had. And he came full of material desires, and he ended up with pure bhakti. Because when you approach Krishna, then you get purified. But he lamented afterwards. He said that, I came to you for all these material reasons, and now that I have you, now I lament the fact that I ever asked for anything material at all. He wished he hadn't. Kurnath Prabhu.
I was looking at these verses, Tesham Gyani Nitya Yukta, and the purports, and it was interesting that, and Nitya Yukta means also he's constantly engaged, and Prabhupada is saying in full knowledge of Krishna, and it's interesting that he's saying that, the one reason that the Gyani Nitya Yukta is special is that he's not seeking anything else. Because he's full of knowledge of Krishna, that it's not coming with, for some exchange that he wants something and he gets it from Krishna and then that person makes some advancement too. But it's a different, I think, as you were saying before, that what knowledge really means is described in the 13th chapter and also in verses 8 through 12, there's this whole list of things that mean knowledge, and it's not the same necessarily as, what people in the university think of as knowledge, which is all on the basis of accepting the body as the self and not really knowing about the field and the north of the field. But just like you were saying about Dhruva Maharaj, that when someone has real pure bhakti, then they are in full knowledge, and because they don't want anything but Krishna, they know the relative value of things. That Krishna, serving Krishna, is the only thing of any value, and so they're not going to Krishna to say, please make me wealthy, remove my distress, satisfy my curiosity.
Thank you. There, Krishna mentions in the 9th chapter, Jnana yajnena chapyanye yajanto mamupasite ikatvena pritakvena bahuda vishvato mukham. He says, he mentions that people look for him in all kinds of ways. All kinds of ways. Some people worship him as the universe. Some people worship themselves as Krishna. And he says, okay, these are all good because at least they're, it's some kind of attempt towards self-realization. But he doesn't say, these are the best. These are the best thing. People are definitely looking here, there, and everywhere. In fact, in one, you can make the case that, first of all, we're never disconnected from Krishna. Disconnection is impossible because we're part and parcel of Krishna, and all energy is Krishna. We're enveloped by Krishna in every moment. Mistakenly, we're separated through consciousness. Ritertam yat pratieta na pratieta chatmani tad vidyadatmanom hayam yatabhaso yatatamaha. Because I see that things are separate from Krishna, therefore I'm seeing the shadow. And it's a reflection that appears to be in darkness. And it has no value. It's not valuable. And there are stages of consciousness starting with annamoy, which means that my connection to Krishna is through nourishment. Like there are plankton in the ocean, and they're being nourished by the sun. And this is their connection to Krishna, actually, is that's Krishna. Krishna is the sun, and they're eating by absorbing that radiation, and that's Annamoy. And all kinds of living entities, they just live to eat, basically, and that's their connection with Krishna. And again, above Annamoy is Pranamoy, becoming aware of the life symptoms, and then Gyanamoy, and then considering the difference between life and the field. And then Vijnanamoy, actually realizing one's spiritual position, and then Anandamoy, or entering back into one's relationship with Krishna. So Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, "Ye yata mam prapadyante tamstatayva bhajamyaham, mama vartmana vartante manushya parta sarvasya." Everyone's on my path, and as they surrender to me, I reward them accordingly. So one very important point is that those who are on the direct path of devotional service surrender to Krishna, because that's what Krishna says to do. He says, just forget all these other processes and surrender to me, and I will deliver you from all sinful reaction. Do not fear. I shouldn't take some, it's not expedient or glorious to take some indirect route just for the sake of it. And if you go to medical school and then you start telling the teachers, look it, everything you say is fine, but I want to do it in my own way. Will you endear yourself to your professors or to your patient, your future patients, when they come to you and say, where's your diploma? And they say, diploma, shlomoma, I don't need all that stuff. I did it in my own way. And you'll flee from that place before you'll have even a minor surgery in that office. And similarly, those who are progressive on the path of going back to Godhead, they take Krishna's process. It's standard. It's in the Bhagavad Gita. What Krishna says is standard. And they say, okay, what does Krishna say in the Bhagavad Gita? There's speculation all over the place. And generally, it's because people don't consult the Bhagavad Gita carefully. Can I worship demigods? Can I do this? Can I do that? Whichever way I want to do it is fine. But is that what it says in the standard book, which is the Bhagavad Gita? Yes. And then Rakshit.
I thought it was a nice thought, though, that all these people are studying things, chemists, physicists, psychologists, political scientists, philosophers, and everything, that that maybe after 100 years or 150, 200 years, I hope it doesn't take 1,000, 10,000 years, maybe they'll come to realize that the Bhagavad Gita is the ultimate, is the ultimate standard of knowledge, and that pure devotional service is really the ultimate goal. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that he's the goal of knowledge, right? Vedaischa sarvairaham eva vedyo.
I think it's nice too, but I don't think it's restricted just to people who suffer through the process of accumulating useless knowledge. I think it's also inclusive of people who suffer through the process of birth and death, who are illiterate and get beat down by the process of material nature, and bahunam jamanamante, after many, many births and deaths, when they become fortunate, then they surrender to Krishna. Whether it's in the academy or whether it's, you just get slaughtered over and over again by material nature and then somehow you become fortunate, then you surrender to Krishna. But I don't think, it's nice. It's nice that everyone comes to the process.
But I mean that those who in our society who are seen as the arbiters of truth and the possessors of wisdom and knowledge, they ought to be those who are, expounding the importance of Bhagavad Gita and the process of knowledge that's described in the 13th chapter, knowledge of the field and the knower of the field, and the beginning with the humility, pridelessness, this list of things that Krishna declares to be knowledge, especially devotion to him. It'd be nice that, that it seems to me that in modern civilization, the conception of knowledge is wrong. That they feel that simply knowledge of, partial knowledge or relative knowledge is the goal, and they don't have this idea that what you get from knowledge is that you become a devotee of Krishna.
So what's your point?
I thought that this gentleman was saying, maybe...
What is your name?
Swaroop was saying maybe in 1,000 years or 10,000 years, after studying everything, people will finally come to know Krishna, and I thought, yes, and at that point, they'll they'll say that becoming a devotee of Krishna is the goal of knowledge,
and
that studying,
that's nice.
Studying Bhagavad Gita, and you know, I'd like to see that day when the universities, you know, are all they have different departments of different kinds of relative knowledge and things, knowledge how to do things and accomplish things, but ultimately. They accept that Bhagavad Gita is the ultimate book of knowledge and the ultimate
standard. Well, I think that's a nice idea.
like Prabhupada says in the Srimad Bhagavatam.
I'm all for it.
That's why we're
preaching Krishna consciousness.
What's the verse in the fifth chapter of the first canto? Where it says that learned circles have concluded that the ultimate result of Vedic sacrifices and study and all these things is to glorify Uttama Shloka. You know that verse? But in the purport, Srila Prabhupada says, you know, those who are scientists, you know, should practice, you know, proving the glories of Krishna through science. And those who are politicians and statesmen, they should establish Krishna through their work and
yeah,
so forth.
Definitely. No question. Yeah.
I wanted to comment a little more on that earlier comment that was made that this type of knowledge that is being pursued in universities will ultimately lead to perfect knowledge, which is what Krishna is preaching in the Bhagavad Gita. But actually, if you look at the progress of universities, they are light years away with the method that they are using to come to understand God. There was a comment that was made by Srila Prabhupada when he went to MIT, where he was invited to give a talk, where he said, "Do you have a department of the soul?" And he said, "Where is your department?" They said, "No, we don't have it." "Do any universities have a department of the soul?" So they said, "No, we are not aware of that." That was 1975 or earlier, and we are now into 2010, and I don't know if there is a department of the soul anywhere. There are probably departments of religion that talk about the soul, but not really a department of the soul. And the point that I wanted to make is this, that Krishna makes the distinction between the material paradigm and the living entity. He says in the Bhagavad Gita that there is one form of energy, which is this lower energy, that's the material world, through which the cosmic manifestation is made. But there is a superior energy to that, which is the living entity, and it's in a different paradigm because it has the property of consciousness. Just now, when we were reciting the 13th chapter, we came across that important verse 1334, where it points out that consciousness is the symptom of the soul, is that when the soul departs from the body, consciousness departs. The body just returns to the earth. So there is a possibility from a scientific perspective that Akranath Prabhu was talking about, which would lead scientists to know about the soul or to know about the living entity, is to start through this paradigm of consciousness. And just to make a point about that, there have been people like this. There was Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, who was at Salk Institute, and he spent his later years working on consciousness. But I don't know if other scientists have picked up on it, and we still don't have a department of the soul in a scientific curriculum. We may have it from a religious perspective. They are teaching the literatures, but science has not yet arrived at this paradigm of coming face to face with what a living entity is. It's a different form of energy that has this property of consciousness. So I'm not absolutely certain that the method of science that is used right now will lead them to know the soul. It's when they start accepting that there is a different paradigm, such as consciousness, then there is a possibility they may arrive at.
Nice points. I would like to make an extension to that point, which is mentioned in this chapter. The chapter 13 that we read, Krishna, in verses 8 through 12, describes what he says is knowledge, or you could say the process to coming to understanding the superior nature as distinguished from the inferior nature, the difference between the body and the soul. This is on page 573. And these are the elements that he gives as the process of actual knowledge. And I'll read them out. Humility, pridelessness, nonviolence, tolerance, simplicity, approaching a bona fide spiritual master, cleanliness, steadiness, self-control, renunciation of the objects of sense gratification, absence of false ego, the perception of the evil of birth, death, old age, and disease, detachment, freedom from entanglement with children, wife, home, and the rest, even-mindedness amid pleasant and unpleasant events, constant and unalloyed devotion to me, aspiring to live in a solitary place, detachment from the general mass of people, accepting the importance of self-realization and philosophical search for the absolute truth, all these I declare to be knowledge, and besides this, whatever there may be is ignorance. So in this technical chapter where Krishna is delineating the difference between matter and spirit and what is how to come to real knowledge, he gives this definitive process. And it interestingly begins with humility and pridelessness. Humility, pridelessness, and nonviolence. So whatever system of getting knowledge includes these has a chance of coming to this position. And without it, Krishna's own words, all these I declare to be knowledge, and besides this, whatever there may be is ignorance. The Upanishads say, Anyad evahur sambhavat, anyad ahur asambhavat, iti shushrumatiranam yenas tadvichakshade. One result is obtained by worshipping the supreme cause of all causes, and a different result is obtained by worshipping that which is not supreme. He also says, vidyam chayas tadvedo bayamsa. No, anyad evahur vidyaya, anyad ahur avidyaya, iti shushrumatiranam yenas tadvichakshade. There's vidya and advidya, and you get a completely different result when you cultivate vidya than when you cultivate avidya. Cultivation of avidya leads to more avidya. Cultivation of vidya leads to elevation and understanding of my superior nature. So, sort of an exhaustive or semi-exhaustive discussion based on your excellent question and points. Swaroop, thank you very much. Any other last questions or points? Akurnath Prabhu. I think we found the smoking gun. Akurnath looks happy.
No, it's just, that verse that I was talking about from the fifth chapter of the first canto, I found it in the verse book. It says, Idang hipungsas tapasak shrutasya vas vishtasya suktasya chabudhi datta yaho avichyuto tak kavipir nirupito yad utama shloka gunanu varnanam. Learned circles have positively concluded that the infallible purpose of the advancement of knowledge, namely austerities, study of the Vedas, sacrifice, chanting of hymns, and charity, culminates in the transcendental description of the Lord who is defined in choice poetry. He was urging Vyasadev to write Srimad Bhagavatam and glorify Krishna in choice poetry. And then he was saying that all of the processes of advancement of knowledge culminate in this Srimad Bhagavatam.
And
literature.
If they don't, Shrama Evahi Kevalam.
Yeah, Shrama Evahi Kevalam.
Dharma Swanastita Pumsam.
Or there's another one that says that it simply interacts with different
forms, names, and results to agitate the mind the way a boat is agitated on the water when
exactly.
It has a resting place.
Yeah.
So Bhagavatam's, yes, you have a point? Question, okay. Yeah. Microphone's coming.
Prabhuji, in the verse 6.7, in the purport, Prabhupada is describing, and he says that the living symptoms represented by consciousness and conviction are the manifestation of the subtle body, mind, ego, and intelligence. In the first chapter of the purport, towards the end of the first paragraph.
I'm sorry. I missed that because of the noise.
Verse 6 and 7, mm-hmm. the first paragraph, towards the end of the first paragraph.
The living symptoms represented by consciousness and conviction?
That's right, Prabhupada. Yeah.
Are the manifestation of the subtle body, mind, ego, and intelligence. These subtle elements are included within the field of activities?
Right, yeah. So my question was, what does he mean when he says conviction there?
Well, all those are listed under the as the as the result of the subtle body, or the power of the subtle body to decide things. Thinking, feeling, and willing becomes manifest from the subtle body, and conviction is just one category of that kind of thinking, feeling, and willing.
Consciousness is one which makes things move, right? And be active.
Yeah. The soul actually is the driver of the body, and ultimately he's the life behind the body, but it's manifest through the subtle body, the mind, intelligence, and ego. And according to the conditioning of the mind, intelligence, and ego, the subtle body, which gets conditioned by material nature, it's like Prabhupada mentioned, it's like a spool. All of one's experiences and desires are wound up like in a spool, and we express those in our endeavors for different goals in this world. And I may have a conviction for that. My main goal in life is to become president of the United States. Why I'd want to do that? But somebody has that conviction. Somebody else has a conviction to become a truck driver or something else. But all those kinds of convictions are a result of my conditioning and my subtle body. The subtle body becomes dissolved by the process of devotional service, just as the way food becomes dissolved when you put it into your stomach. Kapila Dev says this when he's speaking about Sankhya and the subtle body. That subtle body through which we're connected to the gross body and to the convictions for moving forward in our material endeavors in life becomes reduced and ultimately dissolved. Yes.
So what happens if our subtle body is dissolved while we're still alive in our gross body?
Well, this is the gross and subtle body are called our prarabdha karma. And their prarabdha means present. It means that there are different phases of karma, and the one that's bearing fruit now is this body. It's a result, what I have now is a result of everything I did previously. And you can't take it back. It's already manifest. But Brahma Sakshat Krita Nishchayapi Vinashamayati Vinada Bhogai Upaiti Nama Spuranena Tate Prarabdha Karmeti Viroti Vedaha. Rupa Goswami says, by connecting with the holy name, actually experiencing Krishna through the holy name, one can destroy one's prarabdha, the prarabdha karma. And through the process of devotional service, actually, it's a fact that the latent karma and also the prarabdha karma becomes destroyed. That's proved in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Yanamadeya shravanadu kirtanat yat pravanat yat smaranat apikuchit svado pisadyo savanaya kalpate punakunaste bhavanarandu darshanat. Shukadev Goswami says that person who has come in contact with the chanting of the holy name of the Lord no longer has... that person actually can rise to the position of a Brahmin. That means that whatever prarabdha was there has been destroyed. And that the body is different. It actually becomes a transcendentalized body. And this was proved also in Chaitanya's Leela when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu embraced Haridas Thakur. When Thakur Haridas, who was in an untouchable body, according to the culture, gave up his life, he left his body, Mahaprabhu personally picked up his body and put him in samadhi, proving and showing that actually his body was completely transcendental. What happens to a person who whose body becomes transcendental even in this life. First of all, iha yasya harer dasye karmana manasa gira nikila apiyavasta su jivan mukta su uchite. One who is fully engaged, body, mind, words, in the service of Krishna is a liberated person even in this life. This is Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Rupa Goswami says, one is liberated even in this life. However, we may still be walking around with a with the material body. So a person who enters fully within devotional service, Dikshakali, Bhaktakari, Atma Samarpan. Krishna says that a person who enters fully into devotional service, who surrenders to me, especially through the process of Diksha, taking initiation, surrendering, that person becomes as good as me, Krishna says, as good as my in quality as me. And then one attains what's called a sarana deha. The what was a gross material body and contaminated subtle body, it becomes what's called a practitioner's body. And you may not have attained full perfection at that point, but a green mango and a ripe mango are both mangoes. And you will attain that state. Or you may join a football team and be a rookie, and you may not play. But because you are in the on the team, even though you sit on the bench, wow, that's really good. Then when they win the championship, you also get a ring because you're there. You know, you're in. For those who have, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, for a person who has become completely liberated in this life, attained the perfectional stage, Krishna sometimes maintains his gross and subtle body. Maintains a gross and subtle body. It appears that he's walking around with a what would appear to be a material a subtle body, but it's actually something which is being maintained by Krishna, so that person can continue to do devotional service in this world to spread Krishna consciousness. So, it's not, you know, when the subtle body is dissolved. It also means that it is purified. Cheto darpana marjanam. It means that the all the subtle desires for and false ego for self-interest in this world are extinguished, and one's only ego is I am a servant of Krishna. Naham vipro nacha narapatir napi vaishnava shudro. I'm not a vaishya. I'm not a brahman. And I'm not anything else. I'm the servant of the servant of the servant of Krishna, and this is real ego. And therefore, the subtle body is a purified state. Is that all right?
Great.
Something. Okay, so now we're going to dissolve our subtle bodies. But tonight, we're going to teach you one very important process. Many of you may already know this, but this is part of the Artik ceremony as taught by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. What we're having tonight in this small room is an Artik ceremony. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu began this process of Samkirtan in the home of Srivas Thakur. And for 1 year, he and his associates went inside the house and they locked the door. They didn't let anybody else in. In fact, they didn't want anybody in the room who wasn't fully appreciative of what they were doing because it would bring the spirit of the place down. In fact, sometimes people tried to sneak in. Once Srivas Thakur's mother-in-law hid inside the house in a basket. And they started the kirtan, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is dancing and dancing in the kirtan. And then he said, he stopped and he said, I'm not feeling any ananda. There must be some impure person in this house. And they found that Srivas Thakur's mother-in-law was hiding inside the house, so they gently asked her to leave. Another time, a young Brahmin came who was very austere. He had spent his whole life as a brahmachari, and he said, I maintain my body only by drinking milk. So Srivas Thakur said, well, Mahaprabhu doesn't let anybody in except for certain devotees, but because you're so austere, he said, please come in. And the Brahmin came in and hid, and again Mahaprabhu started the dancing, and he stopped and said, I'm not getting any ananda. There must be some impure person here. And finally, Srivas Thakur produced this young Brahmin, Brahmachari, and he said, it's only him. He only drinks milk. And Mahaprabhu became angry. He said, if this was the qualification, then all the babies in the world can also come in. He must leave. But as he was leaving, as he was expelled, he thought, at least I saw Mahaprabhu dance. I'm fortunate. And Mahaprabhu understood his heart, that he was sincere, and he called him back. And Mukunda was a similar case. Mukunda was asked to go away and not come back. Mahaprabhu was angry with him. And he became morose. They told him, Mahaprabhu said, he will not see you for 10 million births. You can go, and he will see you after 10 million births. And Mukunda began dancing. And they said, why are you dancing? He said, at least he will see me. 10 million births, whatever it is, I don't care, he'll see me. Then Mahaprabhu called him back. Inside the house of Srivas Thakur, everyone please move up by 17 inches. And inside the house, they danced to the kirtan. Now, this is an important part of chanting the holy name together. And in bhakti, there's dancing. Dancing is a very important part of bhakti. Mahaprabhu danced everywhere he went. And so this dancing is very simple. There's a simple dance which is passed down to us through disciplic succession. And tonight we'd like to teach you this dance so that during the kirtan, during the artik ceremony, at intervals when you like, you can do this bhakti dance along with the chanting. And it enhances your chanting and your feeling of bhakti by a thousandfold. Would you like to learn the dance? Okay. So let's put the books away and then on all the asanas. And then just before we start the kirtan, I'm going to show you the bhakti dance that Srila Prabhupada personally taught to all the devotees. And then you can try it tonight. Okay? Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gaur Bhaktivinoda ki jai, Gaur Prema Nande Hari Bol.